From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is the New York Times before the Iraq War.
Well, I guess we shouldn't go to war. It's probably not a good idea if we went to this war.
And then as soon as we're in the war,
okay, everybody, now let's get behind the war. Okay.
It's like, you know, this is what you've got to admire about the right wing. They have the courage of their convictions. They don't waver. They believe, you know. They're for the war in the morning, noon, and night. And they don't.
Today, Michael Moore asking, dude, where's my country? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least three Americans traveling with a U.S. diplomatic convoy have been killed in a bomb blast in the Gaza Strip. Killed in the blast were three American security guards who were traveling with a U.S. monitoring team that was in Gaza to supervise the implementation of the U.S.-backed peace plan. The deaths occurred after a Jeep Cherokee carrying the Americans was bombed or drove off a roadside landmine. No group took responsibility for the attack. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Korey condemned the attack and called for an investigation. The BBC reports this marks the first time a U.S. target has been hit inside the Palestinian territories. The blast occurred just hours after the U.S. vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution that condemned Israel's construction of a massive wall through the West Bank. Israel's argued the wall is needed for security reasons. Palestinians see it as an apartheid wall. In response to the U.S. veto, the Syrian ambassador said, quote, to be very frank, the image of the United States as a superpower, as a co-sponsor of the peace process, will definitely suffer. The vote marked the second time in a month the U.S. used its veto power to block a resolution criticizing Israel. In Baghdad, a car bomb exploded yesterday outside the Turkish embassy, killing the driver and at least one bystander. The attack on the embassy was seen as a response to the Turkish plan to send 10,000 troops to Iraq. One eyewitness told Agence France-Presse, quote, this appears to have been a letter to Turkey, a letter of refusal. It marked the third car bombing this week against collaborators with the U.S. occupation. Pentagon advisor Richard Perle yesterday spoke publicly backing Israel's bombing Syria and said the U.S. should also not rule out attacking Syria. Perle said, quote, we have problems with the Syrians who continue to support terrorism. We have to find a way to get them to stop. A new ABC Washington Post poll has found only 46% of voters in the U.S. would now vote to elect Bush, marking Bush's weakest showing to date. And nearly 60% of Americans say the number of U.S. casualties in Iraq has become unacceptable. A federal judge has ordered journalists from the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Associated Press, and CNN to reveal their sources and to state who within the government supplied them with derogatory information about Wenho Lee. Lee, the former nuclear weapons scientist who was once suspected in a major spy case, is suing the government in part for damages caused by unnamed governmental officials who leaked information to the press. And the United Nations Security Council appears poised to approve a U.S. resolution that would preserve Washington's power over occupied Iraq and give greater legitimacy to the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. France, Russia, and Germany have all dropped demands to give the United Nations greater power in Iraq's reconstruction. Resolution also drops their demand that a schedule is set up to determine when the U.S. would hand over power to Iraq. Secretary General Kofi Annan said the resolution only solidifies Washington's power and may not help make the country become safer. He said, quote, as long as there is occupation, the resistance will grow. We turn now to Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, about the significance of the UN vote. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Can you talk about what's expected to be voted on today?
The resolution that the U.S. has put forward in the Council does not meet the basic requirements that other countries have said would be required for them to accept the U.S. occupation. That is, that they are looking for a greater role for the United Nations, UN centrality in running the transition to Iraq's return to sovereignty, and of an upgraded or very quick timetable by which time Iraq would regain its sovereignty. The Bush administration's latest version, the version that may well be voted on today, does not even come close to meeting those requirements. It changes only cosmetic aspects. It sets a December 15th deadline, but only a deadline for the so-called Iraqi Governing Council to set a deadline itself by which time they would be prepared to have a constitution ready. It doesn't do anything to give the UN a central role. As Kofi Annan had said, it does not represent a major shift. Those were his words. Now, it may be that the U.S. today does not, in fact, get, at the last minute, the requisite 9 votes and no vetoes. It's virtually certain that none of the other 4 veto-wielding countries, the relevant ones being China, France, and Russia, will veto. But if all of those countries abstain, and there are also several more abstentions from Germany and perhaps a few others, the U.S. may well not get its 9 votes. If it does get its 9 votes, it will look unlike a real vote of confidence by the Security Council. It will look much more like a grudging, reluctant, divided council. The possible yes votes, the likely yes votes, are, of course, the United States and Britain, along with Bulgaria and Spain. They need to get 5 more out of the so-called uncommitted 6, the 6 that stood defiant last year, those 6 being Cameroon, Angola, Pakistan, Chile, Mexico, and Guinea. And whether the U.S. can get 5 of those 6 countries to vote yes is very unclear. The pressure has been fierce at the U.N. If the U.S. gets its way, it will do so by the skin of its teeth, and the resolution that emerges will not be an indication of international support for Washington's continuing occupation.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much. Speaking to us from Washington, author of Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. As we turn now to Rafah in Gaza, the U.N. estimating that over 1,200 Palestinians have been left homeless in the last few days during massive raids. We turn now to online journalist Mohammed Omar in Rafah.
150 houses were completely demolished in Rafah refugee camp. Other 70 houses were partially demolished. Many of the trees were demolished in that attack. Over 960 people were injured. In addition, 9 people were killed. 14 of them were children, and 21 were women. The attack was really miserable. I can't remember where the F-16 when it was showing. I can remember this man, this old man who was called Muhammad Sarfandi, 65 years old. He was waving to the bulldozers, to the driver of the bulldozer, just to ask him to stop because he wants to get his furniture out of his house. I saw the light of the bulldozer in his face. The bulldozer attacked the house, and he shouted. The man shouted, "Stop, stop, stop." No one hear him. No one hear him. Just the bulldozer attacked him again and again. And then the man fell down, and he and the ambulance driver tried to get the area and carry his body, but they wasn't able to carry his body because the Israeli soldiers who shot them shot 2 of the ambulance drivers.
Mohammed Omar speaking from Rafah. His reports can be found at www.rafah.zve.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to our show today with Michael Moore, the filmmaker, the author, the TV producer. Thousands of people on their feet last night in Chicago cheering as Michael Moore took the stage in McGaw Memorial Hall. Moore began the speech by saying, quote, "Thank you. I just wanted to relive my Oscar night." Moore was booed by some at the 2003 Academy Awards when, during his acceptance speech for Best Documentary for Bowling for Columbine, he talked about war. Let's go back to that night.
And the Oscar goes to Bowling for Columbine. Michael Moore and Michael Donovan.
This is the first Academy Award and nomination for Michael Moore and Michael Donovan.
On behalf of our producers, Kathleen Glynn and Michael Donovan from Canada, I'd like to thank the Academy for this. I've invited my fellow documentary nominees on the stage with us. And we would like to... They are here in solidarity with me because we like... No man sending us to war for fictitious reasons, whether it's the fictitious of duct tape or the fictitious of orange alerts. We are against this war, Mr. Bush. Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you. And anytime you've got the Pope and the Dixie Chicks against you, your time is up. Thank you very much.
Michael Moore winning the Oscar and talking about war. Well, Michael Moore has a new book out after his best-selling number one New York Times bestseller, Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Nation, came out just after September 11th, and HarperCollins, his publisher, threatened to pulp it. Well, he has a new book now. It is called Dude, Where's My Country? We sat down to talk about it. Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Michael Moore. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you for having me. Actually, should we tell people where we're at?
You can tell.
we're in the middle of the Time Warner Empire here on some floor. You know, we've kind of taken over and barricaded ourselves in the room here.
The question is, will we leave when the fire drill begins? Or is the fire drill happening because we are here? I don't know.
There's no fire drill. Maybe they just want us out of here.
Well, Michael, you have written another whopper. This one is called Dude, Where's My Country? Michael Moore, of course, author of Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Nation, and the Academy Award-winning producer and director of Bowling for Columbine. It's great to be with you again. This is quite a book.
Well, thank you.
You start right in. Well, you start about the saga of getting Stupid White Men published,
right,
and then you move right into Saudi Arabia. Tell us about both.
Well, I think a lot of people probably who, you know, listen to you know the story about Stupid White Men and how HarperCollins had to rewrite 50% of the book and take out all the criticism of Bush or tone it down or, you know, just, you know, I couldn't have chapters like, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Kill Whitey, you know, you have to take that out, you know, because as they explained to me, Whitey is no longer the problem, Mike. And I said, listen, Whitey is always the problem. That chapter staying in.
I remember talking to you in that period when the book was put off from being published. You were rather glum. Mm-hmm. You were engaged behind the scenes in a very fierce battle.
Yeah, I was. I'm laughing about it now, as is always the case, isn't it? But you're right. And as you know, during that time, I was. It looked like they were going to. They had printed 50,000 copies. They were holding them in a warehouse, and they got to the point where they told me they were going to shred all 50,000 copies. And
at your expense?
Yes, and that I would have to, and they would not give me the book back so I could just take it and sell it someplace else. It was just, you know, it was just going to be, you know, disappeared. And especially when you have you know, people that are supposed to be supportive of you, lawyers and those types who are saying, you know, Mike, you better compromise here. You're never going to get another book deal. No one's ever going to publish. No one, you're going to be trouble. You'll be known as trouble. I said, I'm already known as trouble. That's what I mean. I'm not the worst thing we can do right now is to censor. The worst thing we can do right now is to alter the way that we believe that we are here in a free society. You know, what is all this? You know, we're going to fight for freedom, and the way we're going to fight for freedom is by taking away our freedoms. I mean, it is just such a bizarre concept. So, anyways, they had basically given me the word that it's too bad. That's too bad you have that position. So that's the end of you. And I went out the next day to New Jersey and told this group that I was speaking to. This group was a consumer action group. You know what was going on and whatever. And there was this librarian in the room. She went home and got on the internet and sent out this letter to librarians all over the country telling them they're going to ban Michael Moore's book. And it just started a flood of emails to HarperCollins from librarians librarians in America do something like $2 billion worth of book business every year. I mean, it's a huge business for the publishers. You don't want to upset the librarians. And within a week, they reluctantly changed their position and were very mad at me, thinking I got the librarians behind this or whatever, and I didn't know any of this was going on. And so I tell this story in the book, and I dedicate the book in part to that librarian.
Ann Sparanese, a devoted WBAI listener.
Yes, she is. She's out there in Englewood, New Jersey, the public library. And so it's the book is dedicated in part to her and to Rachel Corey, the young woman who stood in front of the bulldozer there in Gaza and was bulldozed by the Israelis, and two nuns who are old friends of mine from Michigan who are now in prison because they poured blood on missiles out in Colorado a couple years ago. So that's the story of how I got from the last book to this book, and I got out of my contract with HarperCollins.
Although you certainly did well by them, for them.
I know, this is the part that really, bring this up because it really bothers me that they have literally made millions, tens of millions of dollars on this. This book, Stupid White Men, has sold now over 4 million copies worldwide. Probably about half of that maybe in the U.S. and Canada and the rest, you know, overseas. And it's made them a boatload of money. And for them to be rewarded for trying to censor me, it's just, you know, so I don't like being reminded of that.
Maybe it'll challenge the whole publishing industry, the idea that just this proliferation of right-wing imprints that are developing and people are paving, I mean, that this book can pave the way, as well as this one, Dude, Where's My Country, to an opening for people who have a different point of view.
Absolutely. Because, you see, here's the thing. We hear about these conservative books all the time and how Ann Coulter's doing so well or Bill O'Reilly's doing so well, and it's like, you know, why don't they tell the truth? Actually, those books, they come and go. They didn't sell those books to Ann Coulter and Bill O'Reilly combined didn't sell what my book sold. And you have all these books from Jim Hightower to Molly Ivins to there's a whole bunch of books on the list right now that that come from the left side of the fence. And that's because I think that's where the majority of American people are. I think there's been a shift in public opinion, and I write about this in this book. That we actually live in a very liberal country, and it's never reported that way in the news. But the truth is that the majority of Americans are pro-choice. The majority of Americans want stronger environmental laws. The majority of Americans are pro-labor. You go down the whole list, even on the one issue where they're conservative, the death penalty, where the majority of Americans still support it, that support has dropped from like 80% down to 50-some percent. And I think it's going to drop even more because of all the revelations that we've had innocent people on death row. So, you know, I'm very optimistic about, you know, our fellow Americans. The problem is that they just don't have anybody to vote for. They're liberal on the issues, but where are the liberal leaders? It's liberal leaders become an oxymoron, you know, because liberals don't lead, the typical liberals that we're used to, you know. The whole thing with Gray Davis is a perfect example of how the voters will rise up and reject anybody who calls themselves a liberal or a Democrat, but then behaves like a Republican. And the, when the voters of California had a choice between, you know, essentially two Republicans, Arnold and Gray Davis, why wouldn't you go, why would you go with a hamburger version when you can get the prime rib? I mean, there's this great study that those two professors at Manchester College in Indiana did after the Gingrich Revolution in 94, where they wanted to figure out why did the Republicans take over so many seats in Congress. And what they found was that the Democrats running for Congress who tried to modify their message, who tried to be more middle of the road, who tried to be more Republican-like, they were the ones who lost that year. The Democrats that stuck to their guns, that stuck to their liberal positions, those are the ones who won in that election. And the point is that the American people, who by and large don't consider themselves really Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative or whatever, they're just very common sense people who want leaders who are going to lead. And when they look at the people on the ballot, they don't see anybody on the left side of the ballot that has any kind of leadership abilities. You know, they're all the kind of wimpy, wishy-washy, you know, the great liberal paper, the New York Times. You know, this is the New York Times before the Iraq War.
Well, I guess you know, we shouldn't go to war. It's probably not a good idea if we went to this war.
And then as soon as we're in the war,
okay, everybody, now let's get behind the war. Okay.
You know, this is what you've got to admire about the right wing. They have the courage of their convictions. They don't waver. They believe. You know, they're for the war in the morning, noon, and night, and they don't ever stop. You know, and too many people who claim to be on our side are like,
oh well, you know, I guess we could, you know, do it.
You know, so I don't know. We need more people on our side that've got that, you know, whatever that is.
Well, we're talking to Michael Moore, author of Dude, Where's My Country? Back with him in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we return now to the interview with Michael Moore, Dude, Where's My Country? Is his new book.
Well, you've got some questions for, well, you put it, George of Arabia, seven questions.
Yes.
Maybe you can go through them. You're headed to Washington to deliver them, to
yes,
ask those questions.
Right. Yes, that's correct.
So can you talk about them? They've also appeared in ads, one question at a time. The question, and then your evidence for what's backing up the question.
Well, my first question is, I'd like to know from Mr. Bush what exactly is the business relationship over the last 25 years between the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. I was really stunned the first time I read about this, that the person who handles the Bin Ladens' money in Texas back in the late 70s was also a person who was an investor in Arbusto, one of Bush's first little ventures that his dad set him up with. And it was so astounding to see that potentially, you know, there was Bin Laden money involved with the Bush family. And this goes back to the 70s. Now jump all the way to the Carlyle Group, where you have Bin Laden's investing in the Carlyle Group. This is where George Sr., this group, that, you know, the company that he's involved with. When George Sr. goes to Saudi Arabia, he'd stay, you know, the Bin Ladens are all friends with each other. And it's like, well, what are the chances of that? Of the 6 billion people on the planet you know, that the guy supposedly responsible for the worst terrorist act on our soil, also his family just happens to, you know quite well and be have business relations with the first family of this country. I mean, it's like, and why won't the press ask this question? Maybe it means nothing. Maybe it's just a coincidence that their paths seem to cross in these ways, and maybe it isn't. I mean, I'd like to know that. I think the American people have a right to know. And I say in the book, if after Oklahoma City it had been revealed that Timothy McVeigh's family had been involved in business relationships with the Clintons for 25 years, what do you think the press would have done with that? What do you think the Republicans would have done with that? I mean, they would have gone nuts, you know. And yet, when it's the Bushes and the Bin Ladens, nobody asks the question. Question number two to Bush: what is the relationship between your family and the Saudi royal family? Where are those 28 pages? Why don't we know? You know, I'm talking about the congressional report of 9/11. What are you protecting here? I think we have a right to know what exactly is this relationship. And I talk about the scene here in the book, where two nights after 9/11 on September 13th, he's got Prince Bandar, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia, out on the Truman balcony. They're sharing a cigar, looking out over Washington, while things are still smoldering here in New York City. And they have such a close relationship that the Saudi royal family refers to his dad as Bandar Bush. They've actually given him his own, you know, nickname within the royal family. And this is how close they are, and a lot of this goes to a gut feeling on my part, and it's nothing more than this. But again, you know, you wish that investigative journalists or somebody in Congress would start asking these questions. Was this really a terrorist attack on September 11th, or was it a military attack? Why is it always called a terrorist attack? Why isn't it called a military attack? Because it sure looked like a military attack to me. If you know anything about flying a plane, if you're going 586 miles an hour, you know, the World Trade Center, those buildings were like a block wide. That's not very, I mean, if you're off by a centimeter, you know, that plane is in the East River. To hit it that directly, to do it twice, these people knew what they were doing, and they did not learn how to do that. It's a flight training school in Florida on a video game. They did not learn how to do that there. And I think some questions need to be asked about what involvement did the Saudi military possibly have in either training these people? Were these rogue elements within the Saudi royal family or within the Saudi military? You know, we already know there's huge divisions within the royal family about how the country should be run. It's in total chaos over there. The king has, you know, had a stroke, and he's not really been running the country now for a number of years. I don't have all the answers here, but I'm asking these questions because I think somebody should answer them. And I go through, and there's, you know, more in the about why the Bin Ladens were allowed to fly.
We'll go into that, because each of these things, and now you being immersed in the book and having done research for the last few years, you are now taking them for granted. What is so astounding is most people in this country do not know this, don't know about when the grounding of the air traffic happened in this country right after September 11th. What happened?
And I think if you explain this to the average American out there, that after all the planes were grounded and none of us could fly, and my wife and I know this very specifically because we were stuck out in L.A. We were supposed to fly that day back here, and we had to get in a car, and we drove 3,000 miles. So nobody could fly. I mean, nobody. All planes were grounded for up to 4 days. Right away, the Bush administration gave permission for private Saudi jets to be allowed to fly around America and pick up 24 members and associates of the Bin Laden family in four or five cities and fly them to Boston, where they then got together, and then after a few more days were then flown out of the country to Paris without any kind of investigation by the FBI or real interrogation. Not only that, according to the Times last month, there's now up to 150, 160 members of the royal family and other Saudi officials who were in the country at the time who also got free plane rides and picked up and taken out of the country when no one else could fly. So no one could fly in America on September 12th or 13th unless your name was Bin Laden. I mean, just stop and think about that for just a few seconds. And I don't mean to implicate, I'm not saying that just because your name is Bin Laden, you're automatically guilty of something. It's not what I'm saying. But common sense will tell anyone that, if your brother has just been accused of committing the worst mass murder in American history, would it be wrong for the police maybe to come and ask you a few questions? Not that you had anything to do with it, but just, do you have any idea where he is? If he calls, could you let us know?
Were these people questioned?
No, here's where they were questioned.
after they all got to Boston, they all got on the plane in Boston to get their free trip to Paris. They then allow a couple FBI guys onto the plane to check passports. Their questions were, what's your name? Let me see your passport. And they had just a few minutes, and they were out of there.
Vanity Fair quotes, I think, the head of Logan Airport, saying she was absolutely shocked when they were dealing with the trauma, the crisis of the planes having come from Logan.
Yes.
That hit the World Trade Center. They were now being told, while others weren't allowed to fly, these they were to prepare to make sure that they could fly out.
Yes. And those orders, we now know, came directly from the White House. So here's Bush trying to deal with everything on September 11th, 12th, 13th. You know, everybody remembers the total state of chaos and people, just everyone, all of us, you know, discombobulated by the whole thing. And he had the time to be thinking, what can I do to help the bin Ladens right now? You know, let's make, and all these elaborate plans were made so that, because they were spread out throughout the country, to be able to pick them up, get them to Boston, and then get them to Paris. And of course, what they'll say, if you were to ask them, they'll say, well, we did it for their protection. We were worried about Americans may respond in a hostile way to anyone named bin Laden. Well, first of all, I'm glad he has such a high opinion of us American citizens. It's not really how people are. And secondly, again, let me use the Clinton example. Imagine after the days after Oklahoma City, Clinton sitting around the White House going, I wonder how the McVeigh family is doing up in Buffalo right now. I hope they're okay. You know, maybe, you know, we should be worried. We don't want anything to happen. Why don't we give them a free trip to Paris? How about that? Yeah, call them up and let's arrange some free planes to get the McVeighs to Paris. Because that's exactly what happened with Bush and the bin Ladens. And the FBI, and I'm making this film right now, hopefully I'll get this out sometime next year. And I just interviewed one of the FBI agents, and they were appalled too. They couldn't believe that procedures weren't followed. I said, what is the procedure in a case like this? He said the procedure would be that each of the bin Ladens who were here would have been subpoenaed. They would have come and testified. We would have subpoenaed their phone records. We would have just done a check. And he says, and more than likely, you know, none of them were involved and everybody's okay. But what we would then do is say, look, when you go back to Saudi Arabia, or when you go back to wherever you're going, you know, can we just have a relationship so that if you do find out anything or if you do know anything, you know, could you please tell us? So while we're being told that the hunt is on for Osama bin Laden, what's really going on when you've got 24 bin Ladens here, you know, none of them are asked for any kind of help. None of them are interrogated. And they're given literally the royal red carpet treatment in the days after September 11th. My question is, why? What is really going on here? You know, and then as we saw as the months went by and we forgot about bin Laden and no longer, you know, bin Laden wasn't the main thing. And we know from the things that Wesley Clark has said that in the days right after September 11th, he got a call from people in the Bush administration, connected to the Bush administration, telling him, go on CNN and connect this to Saddam Hussein. This is like September 12th, 13th, you know, connect this to Saddam Hussein.
Michael Moore, are you trying to hide how many Iraqi hijackers there really were that day?
Well, and yeah, this goes into the next chapter of the book. It's called Home of the Whopper, and I list all my favorite Whoppers from the Bush administration. I give them actual, you know, Whopper with cheese, Whopper with fries, you know, biggie size Whoppers, you know, the whole deal here of this Iraq, and of course, you know, saying that Saddam had something to do with 9/11. This was a genius Whopper though, because the American people bought it. They actually believed it. It worked. Karl Rove and these guys must have just been, you know, whoa, this is so cool. We've actually got people buying the fact that Saddam did this. I mean, you have to at least admire the evil genius of these people and how they're able to pull the wool over people's eyes like this. I mean, the good news is that once people are given the truth, and you know, it's because of people like you, it's because of shows like this. It starts out in these little seeds, you know, and the group of people who listen to the Pacifica stations across the country, the people who, you know, read The Nation or, you know, go to things on the website where you can get other information. And it spreads out from there. And now we're at a point where the American people realize they've been lied to. They've been lied to, and they know it. And you know what? People don't like being lied to, especially when they were supportive of this in the beginning.
Question 3.
What about the, question three is one of my favorites. I'd like to ask Bush, who exactly attacked America on 9/11? A guy on dialysis from a cave in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia? Right from the get-go, this thing about Osama bin Laden, you know, the mastermind of all evil in the world, doing this from a cave in Afghanistan, this thing was so well put together. This was so well planned and so well organized, and the communication with 19 people at work here in America doing this, and if you just think about this, and this is all coming from a cave in Afghanistan, I can't get a cell signal from here to Queens. So it's like, exactly how did the mastermind of all evil put this together? I'm not saying he didn't have something to do with it or wasn't involved in it or whatever. I just think it's a legitimate question to ask. I've got this footage from Fox News of that morning. It's like literally within 30 seconds of the second plane hitting, Fox News was calling it for Osama bin Laden, much like they did on election night for Bush. They were like, they just kind of willed it to happen. And then everybody just started saying Osama, 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 Osama. And nobody paused to think, well, okay, yeah, maybe, maybe could it be something else? Is there something else going on here?
You use the example of North Korea.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, poor North Korea. You got to feel bad for them at some point here, right? Because they're, here they are in the axis of evil. They're usually, ignored. North Korea has taught a great lesson to all the countries in the world, especially the rogue countries, dictatorships or whatever. If you don't want to be invaded by America, get some nuclear weapons. I mean, Bush has done more by invading Iraq to encourage nuclear proliferation around the world, because that's really the message of the Iraq war. You had these two axes, these two countries, North Korea and Iraq. Who gets invaded? Well, it's the country that doesn't have the nuclear weapons. They're not going to go after North Korea because they've got these weapons and we don't want to risk them ever being used. So that's the message. There's for all you countries out there who are on the potential axis of evil list, be sure and get some nuclear weapons as soon as you can.
Question four, why did you allow a private Saudi jet to fly around the U.S.? And we've covered that, and right. You put that question out. Right. And question number five.
Why are you protecting the Second Amendment rights of these terrorists, the 19 hijackers and the Ashcroft? The FBI, after September 11th, started checking the background check files for guns. When you go to buy a gun, there's an instant background check and there's a file.
As you know from going to a bank.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you can get the gun in about 5 minutes. That's about how long it takes to run the background check.
As long as you write Caucasian.
Yeah, right.
So the FBI was looking through these to see if any of the hijackers or any of their buddies or whatever had potentially bought weapons in the last couple of years. When Ashcroft found this out, he put a stop to it because the Brady Bill specifically prohibits using the gun background check files for anything other than the instant background check. You're not supposed to use them for anything else. And so suddenly, an administration who doesn't give a damn about any of the other, rights that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, but suddenly the Second Amendment is protected, and even in their death, the 19 hijackers have Second Amendment rights, and damn it, Ashcroft was going to protect them, and nobody was going to find out if they had actually purchased a gun in the last year or so. I think if you tell that to the average American, even the average gun-toting American, they're going to think that is a little weird. That just shows how extreme this administration is.
So explain what Ashcroft prevented from happening again.
That he would not allow the FBI to look into the files to see if any of the hijackers or any of their other associates had bought guns in the last couple of years. And to this day, we don't know, because he stopped the investigation. Because why? Because these hijackers have Second Amendment rights and they're sacred. I mean, this is just complete nuttiness. I'm telling you, the average American, if you just lay that out for them and explain that to them, they start to wonder who the hell's in charge in D.C.
We're talking to Michael Moore. His new book is Dude, Where's My Country? Back with him in a minute.
Rock the nation. Rock the nation. Rock the nation. Rock the nation.
time and an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the summer shine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine.
Pass the baton. You know his previous book, Stupid White Men. It sold 4 million copies. His film, Bowling for Columbine, won an Academy Award. And now he has a new book out, and he's traveling the country. Dude, where's my country? Question number six.
Number six is, what were the Taliban doing in Texas while you were governor, meeting with your oil company buddies? While Bush was governor, Taliban leaders made a number of trips to Houston to discuss with UNICAL the building of a pipeline across Afghanistan to bring natural gas from the Caspian Sea region through Afghanistan out into Pakistan and out to the sea. And the Taliban were wined and dined in Houston and given the red carpet treatment. And this is at a time when we knew what the Taliban were up to and what they were doing to women in Afghanistan or whatever. And I would like to know why Bush's top funders and supporters were hosting the Taliban in Texas. Again, I think if you explain this to most Americans, they're going to, what do you mean? And I lay it all out in the book, and I have all there were articles about it at the time. The BBC did a great story on it. Foreign press usually is the best when covering things like this. But it appears now that these negotiations got reopened just before 9/11, that the Bush administration went, that there was still this discussion going on about building this pipeline across Afghanistan. The Bush administration had also opened up a bunch of humanitarian aid to the Taliban, quote, you know, humanitarian aid, because they had joined Bush's war on drugs, and they were going to get rid of the poppy farmers and all this. And so Bush was, while the Taliban, and we knew that they were protecting Osama bin Laden, this is after the African embassy bombings, this is after the USS Cole was bombed, we were in business, essentially, with the Taliban. We had these relations with the Taliban, and I'd like to know why, then all of a sudden, a month later, after September 11th, we're bombing Afghanistan. You know, what was going on? Why were you in bed with these people? What happened? What happened to that deal? Apparently, the deal got called off. Why did it go south? You know, these are just questions that any police officer or any investigative journalist would ask, wondering what connection this has to September 11th.
And you wrote that the Taliban offered to turn over Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, and they did, exactly. And you know, it was ignored. So, you know, but again, Osama was a member of a family that close friends with the Bushes at that time, you know. So it was, again, I think once you start to unravel some of this, and if the right questions are asked, we will learn more information. And I think this is more than just about 19 people wanting to go to heaven and meet 72 virgins. And as much as they could put that story out there and get people to believe it, give the people the simple version, it'll work for them. But if some of us start asking these questions and start poking and prodding and encouraging the mainstream media to do their job, to ask the questions that they should be asking and dig this stuff up, then maybe we'll learn more about what actually happened.
Michael Moore, question number seven.
The last question is, I just want to know from Bush, what was that look on his face when Andrew Card whispered in his ear when he was sitting in that Florida classroom on the morning of September 11th, and he whispered in his ear that America's under attack? I think that everyone remembers the blank look on Bush's face, that sort of, and then he sat there. He sat there and continued reading with the kids while this was going on. And I don't have the answer for this. It just is always, I've just wondered, it was just a weird look. You know, if I came over there right now and whispered in your ear that your neighborhood had just been destroyed, would you say to me, well, Mike, let's talk now about chapter two? I don't get it. What was that? What did that look mean? Did they know something was going to happen? Did they know this was going to happen? Was something happening or not happening according to plan? Was he just a deer caught in the headlights? Was he? Did he? Or was he just saying at that moment, "Why did Dad make me take this job?" Oh, no.
Well, explain how you reconstructed what happened when you go back and look at the reports and hear what he has said afterwards and what he understood at the point when he was walking into this kid's classroom.
Well, that's what's so freaky is that as I lay it all out here, all the things as he recounted what happened that day later, I mean, his story changed a number of times. First of all, he said that he saw the first plane, you know, hit the building. You know, nobody saw the first plane hit the building. That videotape didn't air for a day or so after, you know, when it was found. He knew that the first plane had hit, but he went ahead anyways into the classroom. And then he's told about the second plane. Then he just continues on and on in the classroom there. This is just common sense here at work. I'm just, you know, the way we are as human beings, the way we respond to things, I think, you know, we all kind of know what our response would be, and his response was not a normal response. So in the abnormality of that, it just said to me, well, something else is going on here, and I'd like to know what it is. I'd like to know what it means. That's all. It just sometimes the little tells, the little ways that people react, it reveals that there's something else behind it.
Michael Moore, you've called for Oprah to run for president, and also Wesley Clark. Talk about each.
Failing Oprah, Wesley Clark. Well, Oprah, you know, America loves Oprah. See, this is our problem. We don't have. They run Arnold Schwarzenegger. They run Ronald Reagan. You know, they run these people that the American people, you know, like for some reason. They connect to them. They're stars or whatever. We have people on our side too. Oprah's got good politics. She's got a good heart, and she'll have us all up jazzercising at 6 a.m. This cannot be a bad thing. And reading a book while we're jazzercising. So, America would be better off if Oprah were president. Now, Wesley Clark, I think, you know, look, Bush has got to go. Bush has got to go. Now, I don't say that meaning anybody but Bush. I just don't think that's a good position to take. Sometimes we're worse off when we have a Democrat in there who is, you know, saying he's a Democrat, but, you know, acting like a Republican. I think, you know, and most of the Democrats, let's face it, they're funded by the same people that fund the Republicans. This is two sides of the same coin. And oftentimes the Democrats, they talk a nicer line. They're for the people. They're for the unions. They're for all this. And that's why they're able to get away with, in some cases, like with Clinton, with much worse stuff. You know, the best example I have, you know, I know personally is just in my own hometown of Flint, Michigan. Flint was devastated during the Reagan and Bush years. But we lost many more jobs during the Clinton-Gore years and was really, the nail was put in the coffin during a time we had a Democratic president in office, and he completely ignored places like Flint, Michigan. So, I think we're at a real crisis situation here with Bush, and so we've got to figure out what can we do to beat this guy. And I think the American people, first of all, they hate politicians. The recall in California, if there was a recall election in the other 49 states, they probably would like to recall everybody right now. People are angry. The economy is not good. They were lied to about Iraq. I mean, there's an angry electorate out there, and they're in the mood to get rid of these people, especially the professional politicians. And they would rather vote for somebody who has no experience than to vote for somebody who has the experience with this sort of thing. Clark, I heard him speak here a couple of months ago, and he said these things that I thought this should be out there. People should know about this. The one I mentioned earlier about the calls that he got after 9/11, trying to connect, you know, to 9/11, and he also said that generals of the Pentagon were calling him before the Iraq War, saying, "Get out there and try and convince people, you know, stop. We don't want this war." The Pentagon really didn't want this war. They were dragged into this by Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, that whole crowd there that's running the Bush administration. The professional military people knew this was a mistake. It violated their Powell Doctrine, which is don't start any war that you don't know the way out. There's no plan here. They knew there was no plan. Now they're in it. Now they're in it and they're stuck in it and they don't know how they're going to get out of it. And so, you know, I heard Clark say these things, and I heard him, you know, he was pro-choice, and he's, you know, on stronger environmental laws, and he went down the whole list of things, and I just saw him on C-SPAN here a week ago,
where he was asked about medical marijuana, which he said he supports the states who say that that's okay, that it's okay for the people to use it for that. That he, somebody asked him, do you support the constitutional amendment that says marriage has to be between a man and a woman? He said no. I mean he's willing to take these positions. I don't know if the guy would be any good. I don't know if he's the right person. I'm not endorsing him. There's a lot of good things about Dean. There's a lot of good things. You know, Kucinich is probably the closest to me, you know, politically in terms of the 10 announced, or now 9 announced candidates.
I guess what surprised so many people when you sent out your letter and now in your book on Wesley Clark, I don't think people were surprised that he ran for president, but that he's called the anti-war warrior. This is the man who said the rest of the world has got to get with us. This is the man who presided over the bombing of Yugoslavia.
Well, yeah, I put it in Bowling for Columbine. I'm so upset still about what happened in Kosovo. I mean, it's in my movie. I found a way to work it into a gun movie and draw the connections between the day the largest bombing took place in Kosovo was on the day of the Columbine massacre. So I'm very concerned about that, and I'd like to hear his answers about that. I'd like to hear, you know, exactly what happened. And I read the story in the New York Times last week that offered a whole different explanation of what I've been reading on the internet. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's why I just thought he should be in the debates. And we should hear what he has to say. And I think anytime we've got a 4-star general that seems to be on our side, you know, we should accept that. And people say, well, Mike, you know, he said he voted for Reagan. And I say, well, yeah, so do most of America. if one of them wants to come over to our side, shouldn't we have open arms and say, well, you know what? Okay, maybe this guy screwed up in the past. Maybe, you know, he's, you know, not done the right thing or whatever. But geez, you know, he said he's going to do this and this and that, and he stands for these things. You know, let's hear the guy out. Let's have him in the debates. I think it's a good thing. Well, Mike, he's the butcher of Kosovo. Yeah, well, maybe that's what we need right now is a butcher. We need the butcher of Bush. I mean, I don't know. It's not an endorsement, but it's like, what do we do, Amy? People like us, because here you got somebody like Dean. Okay, Dean's great on all this stuff, but I met with Dean. He told me that he supports the death penalty in 3 different cases. He would allow the death penalty. He won't cut the Pentagon budget. You know, you go down the whole list of things, and I just think, geez, you know. What do we do about? How much do we have to compromise and keep compromising to find the right person?
Well, Mike, your minions are ready to go, so I want to ask you, what do you say Mike's militia should do?
No, but answer my question, though. What do we do? Just tell me, what's your feeling about this? What do we do? Because we've got a year now, and you and I, Amy, Mike, and the millions of others who feel the same way that we feel, we've got to figure this out. We've got to figure out a way to lead the American people to a good place to where, A, we get rid of Bush, but then, B, we don't get something worse in place of it or something similar to it. So what do we do now? Because there will be no Green Party candidate that's going to run and beat anybody. That's not going to happen this year. There's not going to be another independent movement that's going to arise in the next few months. So what do we do? What do we do?
Take back the media. Right? The media is the place where all these messages get put out.
Right.
And how do you think that it can be done? As you've risen to the top, as you made your statement to 1 billion people in the world about the fictitious election and the fictitious war.
Well, I think you nailed it right there. We have to, I think once you give the American public the information, once you give them the facts, they will respond in the right way. And they're just being lied to on a daily basis. And so we have to get it out there, whether it's, okay, I try and get my book out there to people. You know, you've got your show here. Everybody does their bit. The internet is full of great information. You know, I'm going on a tour now across the country. I'll talk to as many thousands as I can to get them to, you know, log on to, you know, read The Nation or read The Guardian or, you know, go to all the other websites that have good stuff out there. And then share it with your coworkers, share it with your fellow students, share this stuff around. People do want to find out the truth, and when they find out the truth, they'll behave in a good way. I believe that. But you're right. The problem is a lack of information and a whole bunch of misinformation that's put out there. And but it still doesn't answer the question, though. What do we do to get rid of Bush? Or is it just because we can't take the position that's anybody but Bush, right? I mean, that's. I mean, we can't go that far with it. I mean, would you vote for Joe Lieberman today? You know, if you're listening on the radio.
So you're headed to deliver your questions to Bush.
Yes, I'm gonna deliver my questions to Bush on the end of this week.
And what makes you think you'll get in?
Bush, I've known him. We go way back. You know, he's. I had him on The Awful Truth. You know, he told me to go find real work. So I hope I've done that now, and I just want to show him how well I've done since he gave me that wonderful advice.
Well, Michael Moore, thank you very much for spending this time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Michael Moore, author of Dude, Where's My Country? You are listening to Democracy Now! And that hour interview we did just as the book came out last week. Well, I have a very big thank you today to the people of Tucson, Arizona. The whole team has just come back from Tucson, where we went to Mexico this weekend, crossed the border covering the action, and we could not have done it without community media in Tucson. Today, we celebrate KXCI Community Radio, where Democracy Now! Broadcasts, as well as Access Tucson, where we broadcast yesterday's program. It was a remarkable experience working with the whole team there, and it really shows the power of community media coming together. You know, Democracy Now! Broadcasts on more than 160 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, NPR affiliates, Pacifica affiliates, public access TV stations. We broadcast on Free Speech TV, Dish Network, Channel 9415, and we're also broadcasting on our website, both video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in this country. Remember, you can bring us to your station as well, either radio or TV. Just go to our website, democracynow.org, and you can find out how. We are getting an average of 1 to 2 stations a week who are coming on board. We really want to thank all the folks at KXCI and Access Tucson. When we were at Access Tucson yesterday, we worked with Sam Barons and Vicki Dempsey, Harold D. Ruth, Larry Foster, Lisa Horner, Earl Kumich, Roy Knappenberger, Kevin Sloan, Elaine Higginbotham, Miguel Ortega, Mark, Eric, Zach, Dennis. At KXCI, Roger Greer and Randy Peterson and Susie and so many others. And it was a really great moment yesterday. We went into the station. Well, some of us were working there all night, but at 3 in the morning for the 5 a.m. broadcast to meet the closed captioner who has been working with us over the last months. Democracy Now! Is closed captioned on television. It means that people have access to Pacifica programming who are deaf and hard of hearing, 28 million Americans. And we had the great opportunity to meet Deanna Baker, who has been there with us through these months. Let your friends know, yes, we are closed captioned. And Deanna is based in Tucson, so she came into the station. It was a truly great moment for us all to meet her. Well, that does it for the program. We also want to thank our incredible crew, the crew that went out there and the crew that stayed back here to make this all happen. Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous and Lenina Nadal and Anna Nagara and Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer with us. Rich Kim was back here working, as well as Johnny Sender. Special thanks to Angela Alston and Simba Russo and Joe Mergio, John Randolph, Chris Zucker, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, Eric Rememu, Jenny Filippazzo, Isis Phillips. Everyone makes this program happen. That does it for the show. Again, our website, democracynow.org. Find out how you can bring us to your station. Tell your friends they can do it too. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.